Hello, everyone. It's your girl, Britta, and welcome to my new podcast, You Britta Vote. On this podcast, I kiki with activists, organizers, and elected officials about all things political, from voting to climate change to LGBTQIA plus equality. Baby, my guest and I will spill the tea on what is happening in the current political landscape and how you can make your voices heard on the issues. As a note, Drag Out the Vote, for which I am the national co-chair, is a partisan nonprofit. So my work there is strictly nonpartisan. But in this podcast, baby, I am speaking from my own personal opinions. So get ready for some unfiltered tea. Let's get into it. Hit it. Today, I will be talking to Representative Malcolm Kenyatta. Malcolm Kenyatta has served as the Pennsylvania state representative for the 181st district since 2019. The North Philadelphia native is the only Black and LGBTQ person elected to Pennsylvania state legislature ever. In 2020, Malcolm was named an Out 100 honoree by Out Magazine, their annual list of the most impactful and influential LGBTQ plus people. He recently announced his bid for the 2022 United States Senate election in Pennsylvania. Please welcome my guest, the one and only Representative Malcolm Kenyatta.
Be. Fill that ballot out, it's a voting spree. Put that mask on, don't touch me. Ain't gonna let voting line shush me. We decide who's in the house on the hill. House on the hill, putting stamps on the bill. We unite to the fight to make America gay. So the American slave, the American way. You Britta vote, you Britta vote, you Britta vote. Now you Britta vote.
All right. Here we go. Okay, ladies and gentlemen, guys, gals, and non-binary pals, please welcome my guest, the Pennsylvania State Representative of the 181st District. It is the one and the only Representative Malcolm Kenyatta. Hi.
Hi, I'm so excited to be with you.
I know, I'm so honored, truly so honored that you are here. I look up to you so much.
I'm back at you.
Thank you so much for coming on the podcast. You to vote. Now, listen, I wanted to start at the very beginning and let people know that you are a young, gay, Black man from Philadelphia who ran for office in 2018, and you already have a national political profile, and baby, it is growing and growing and growing. You are doing the damn thing. It's incredible, and I want to know, like, how did you get into politics? I know that your grandfather, I think, correct, was an incredible activist, and tell me, how'd you do it? Oh, look at him.
So somebody actually like randomly mailed this to me. Some woman he worked with was moving, and she said, hey, I found this picture of your grandfather, and hey, what's your address? Can I mail it to you? And so this really cute little picture of him, which just happens to be right here at this moment as you mentioned him. So there you go.
Oh, I love it. I love it.
but first of all, let me start by just saying thank you to you, because you have an incredible platform as well that you've built through a lot of hard work, sweat, and tears, and you're using it to talk about the most important thing we can do. And that really is secure our democracy for the present and in the future. And so for me, it started very young. You know, my parents divorced when I was pretty young. They had adopted my three siblings. And, you know, we moved five or six times as a kid because my mom couldn't always make the rent. And we were living on this one block, which is in my now State House district. Because as much as we moved, my mom was like, we are staying in North Philly, okay? We are not leaving North Philly.
Yeah.
And so we're on this block, Woodstock Street. And I will never forget, you know, I'd come home and my mom was like smoking a cigarette, okay? Smoking this Newport, and I'm coming home and I'm just complaining about all the stuff on the block. I'm just so upset with the trash and the blight and like, why don't we do anything together as a block and on and on. And my mom's just sitting here and she's looking at me and really without skipping a beat, she said, well, you know what, boy, if you care so much, why don't you go do something about it? And I was like, oh, okay. Like, I thought you were going to give me a hug, but okay. she was tough. And I said, well, all right. And I ran for junior block captain. And that was the first thing I ever did in terms of getting civically engaged. And it gave me from a really early formative point in my life this belief that every single one of us, when we see things that frustrate us, when we see things and see institutions that don't see us, that don't lift us up, that don't allow people to exist in their truth and in their power, that we have a responsibility to not wait around, but we have a responsibility to go do something about it. And that moment has really driven me from there all the way now to running for the U.S. Senate.
I know, and congrats on running for the U.S. Senate. That it's incredible. I mean, truly, your glow up has just been so inspiring, and within national politics. And as a queer individual, it's so nice to see representation, especially from a person of color, to, you know, rise and slay the damn game, honey. You are slaying it, and it means so much to me, and I'm just so grateful and look up to you so much. And, you know, our topic today that we're talking about on this episode is something that's so, so important, and it's something that, you know, that we really can't fit 30 minutes into to just talking about it, but we're going to try. It's about racial injustice, and I think it's so important that we need to educate people, especially our youth, so they understand the importance of recognizing and tackling the inequalities that Black, Indigenous, people of color face every single day. Now, I want to ask you, what is the most important thing we should think about today in dismantling these inequalities?
You know, I think about it from, you know, the vantage point that I'm in right now. And I appreciate you saying that, because, you know, when I'm elected, be the first openly gay man ever to serve in the U.S. Senate, and the first openly gay LGBTQ person of color to ever serve in the Senate. And just think about the fact it wasn't until Richie and Mondaire, you know, a couple of years ago, that we even had any, you know, openly gay Black or Latino in Congress in general. And what that means when you talk about this, I tell folks, you know, diversity is not about this ornamental thing, right? It's not about saying, oh, well, you know what? We haven't had any of those yet. Let's have one of those. So we have a picture that looks more colorful and representative. It really is about policy. It is about the way our systems work and are structured, because by virtue of having the lived experience that we have, having a certain level of ground truth about the issues that we're talking about, that matters to policy. And I see that happen all the time. It's one thing for somebody to say, oh, hey, housing insecurity is awful. Shouldn't we get people housed? Everybody can say that, and a lot of people believe it. But when I talk about that issue, for example, I do talk about it as somebody who moved 5 or 6 different times growing up, who knows what it means to take everything I own, throw it in a couple of trash bags, because you have to go to the next place now. And that is a different experience from somebody just anecdotally laying out that this is a problem. And that is certainly true for queer and non-binary and trans folks, and particularly folks in our community who are people of color. It's one thing for, you know, these companies to wrap their brands and, you know, and gay flags for the month of June, and like, okay, that's good. But it's even better to make sure their boardrooms and to make sure your local elected officials, from city council to school board to the U.S. House, to the State House, to the Senate, to the governorship, it's even better to have those positions and the people in them reflect the fullness of our experience as Americans, because that is how we make decisions that include all of us and make decisions that I believe are more sustainable for the future.
You know, representation is the most important. You know, during your time in the State House, I want to ask, how have you combated the racism that people of color face on a daily basis?
You know what? I will tell you, like, walking in on day one, as you might imagine, this poor little Black gay kid from North Philly with locked hair and a big mouth, when most of my colleagues are straight white guys over 60. Many of them are like, yeah, what the hell is going on? Why are you here? I will tell you, more than anything else, I have faced, let me say it this way. I think that there's been more positive to my experience than negative, frankly. And I will never forget a moment I did have that was more about ageism than anything else. I'm walking in, we have this, you know, little, we call it a little ante room in the back off the house floor. And so it's a little snacks back there, chips and whatever, and coffee and water. And we're waiting to to get coffee. And I'll never forget one of my colleagues, and this was not a fucking compliment, okay, to be clear. He was like, oh my God, you're so young. And I said, yeah, and I got here in half the time as you, so you have a lot to learn from me.
That's it. Read them.
And so I think I remember, I'll never forget, because my partner was finishing his PhD in USC when we first met. And we met on Instagram, which is not like Instagram for real kids. There was like, do you mean? No, I mean Instagram. Everything is a dating app if you use it right. So we met on Instagram.
Absolutely.
We met on Instagram. And I was out with him in California when he still lived out there. And I remember going through a list with him when I was thinking about running a state rep of all the different reasons that I wasn't the right person to do it, of all the different reasons that my experience disqualified me. And when I am in the house, what I've come to find out is that everything I thought disqualified me actually qualified me in ways that I wasn't expecting. And so what I have seen being in rooms is that I am bringing a nuance to the conversation that they don't even know how to bring or talk about, that they just don't have. Because as I said, some of this stuff, you can't get it from a white paper. You can't get it from having a staffer brief you. You can't get it from going doing a town hall. Some of the shit, you just kind of had to be there. And if you weren't there, there is a limit to the way you can engage with these issues. And I'll just say quickly, folks should go and look up Representative Jessica Benham. She joined me and Representative Sims, as it's now three of us, three openly LGBTQ members out of 203. It's three of us, the mighty three. She's the co-chair of my Senate campaign. And I'll never forget, we were talking about folks with developmental disabilities. And before Jessica came in, she was an advocate and started this amazing organization in Allegheny County about folks who have developmental disabilities. She's actually the first member of the General Assembly who is autistic. And we're having this conversation. You have all these people popping up to talk about the bill. And you even had some folks who were going to vote the right way, right? And they were just trying to help. And they were popping up trying to say something to help. But when Jessica got up, you could have heard a pin drop in the room, because she was able to talk about these issues with a level of dexterity, talk about how this legislation would impact caregivers and parents and loved ones of folks in ways that nobody else in that room could understand or debate. And that is what we need at every level of government. People who know what the hell they're talking about on all the issues that are keeping folks up at night.
Absolutely. I think those lived experiences that you can't get that from school. You could go to Harvard and all the things you want to. And you're exactly right. Those lived experiences that they can talk about. In 2020, we all saw the murder of George Floyd, and you know, it just ripped open the already fraught rounds that this country has regarding race and really pushing forward the conversation about systematic racism and white supremacy. And I wanted to know how are you pushing forward this conversation in Pennsylvania, and what are some of the insights that you can share with folks about these important conversations?
So that's a great conversation. I think the uprising that we saw after George Floyd's death is really emblematic of what is required to make big change happen. I will never forget seeing protests in 61 of Pennsylvania's 67 counties, okay? To get 61 of 67 counties in Pennsylvania doing anything is really hard. And what we saw was a sustained engagement in rural communities and exurban communities and suburban communities, certainly in our major metropolitan areas, people coming out demanding that our criminal justice system take a hard look in the mirror at the ways that it's failing folks, particularly Black and brown folks, but poor folks more broadly. And myself and other members of the Black Caucus, when we finally came back to session, very much in the spirit of Fannie Lou Hamer and John Lewis and so many others, we actually did a sit-in in the speaker's rostrum where he gavels in session and where all the proceedings go on. And we did a sit-in and said, no, we are not going to let session begin until we get a commitment that you're going to move some bills that move the needle around police reform, around racial justice, around criminal justice reform. And when we did that, you had so many people who were like, oh my God, like, how could they, you know, how could they do this? You know, my other colleagues are like, what is going on? Nothing like this had ever occurred before. And, you know, we got four bills passed to create a database that folks have to use when hiring, so you don't have officers who have committed misconduct go from one district to the next. So they get fired in one place and then move one county over and get a job in that next county. Now it is Pennsylvania law that before folks hire, they have to go and see if there are red flags. And if there are red flags, folks who hire people in spite of those red flags have to go and publicly say, hey, we know this person has a history of misconduct, but we hired them anyway. This is why. We talked about, we got legislation passed that talked about getting increased training, not just around implicit and explicit bias, but also training around folks who are having mental health challenges, and a number of other things that we got done from a executive standpoint that the governor could do on his own, that local mayors could do on their own. And so there was a lot of movement. When the articles were written, a lot of people said, oh my God, they staged the sit-in and thereby we got this. That's really not what happened. What happened was what I led with. People in 61 of 67 counties showed up. All four of those bills that I mentioned passed unanimously because people, even in conservative districts, said, you know, hey, my people are out in record numbers. I can't vote against this. That is what we need to do things like pass the Equality Act. That is what we need to do things like secure voting rights. That is what we need to do to make sure we take the child tax credit that's getting money into people's pockets right now and make that permanent. That type of mass mobilization is what is going to be required to move the needle. And so, yes, you need good elected officials. But if you say, hey, well, I voted, I'm done. Malcolm, come to me in 2 years and tell me if everything's fixed. That is the exact wrong way. What it requires is what I learned all those years ago as a junior Black captain. You have to get engaged. And whether you are the person who gets to actually make the vote in that chamber or not, you being on the ground, being outspoken, allows the political pendulum to swing toward justice.
It's incredible. I mean, you're shaking things up, and you saying that is what helps other people to also go out there and create change and to shake things up themselves. I mean, 61, that is absolutely incredible. 61 counties that were like, I'm gonna shake it up too. So I love that. It's so important. And speaking of, a lot of times I have to explain to people that, like, you can't be just not be racist. You have to be anti-racist towards all of this. And, you know, a question that I do have is that, like, and most of these conversations that I have are with white people. And what do you most want white people to know when it comes to racial injustice?
You know, the insidious nature of racism, it hurts everybody. It hurts everybody. I think that is certainly Black and brown folks bear the brunt of it. And I don't want to minimize that in any way. But what I'm saying is that there is a cost to racism. When we say that, hey, we are not going to educate certain kids, right, through our inaction on creating equitable funding, everybody and their mama knows that if you are born in a certain zip codes that are predominantly poor, zip codes where folks are predominantly people of color. Everybody listening to this podcast right now, and even folks who aren't listening, know that outcomes are different for those kids. What is the impact of that?
Absolutely.
The impact of that is that you have less people who are put in a position where they can grow up and follow whatever their dream is. And so what we lose are a bunch of incredible young people who have inside of them things that our country, that our cities, that our local communities need to be better. I think about all the time how great ideas are trapped in the minds of people who never got a quality education to help them effectuate those ideas that are in their heads. We also know that when you have folks who did not get a quality education, who didn't go to buildings that were well-resourced, with teachers that were fairly compensated, with all the social support nets that are necessary, what does that mean? It means a lot of those folks end up engaging with our carceral system. What does that mean? That all of us as taxpayers spend a bunch of money warehousing people in prisons instead of them being contributing members of our society. And so I use systematic racism just in education as one example of what happens when we don't do right by every single one of the people in our communities. And that is true. Take housing and redlining and what that means to communities. Go and look at how Black and brown folks are more likely to work these frontline jobs that we praise people for having and praise them for the work that they did, but didn't pay them. What was the impact of that in terms of seeing higher rates of COVID in those communities, right? Putting a greater burden on our health care. And so I make all that point to say that racism and the structural ways in which it's embedded into our society is bad for all of us. It is really bad for all of us.
Yeah.
But the other thing that is important to know is white folks in particular, you have an incredible role that you can play. I will never forget after Secretary Clinton lost, and had a bunch of people, you know, come to me and they're upset. And they're, Malcolm, I'm crying. What should I do? And I said, go to Thanksgiving. That's what you can do. Go to Thanksgiving and talk to the people in your family who voted for Trump.
Absolutely.
And talk about what that means to you and what that's going to mean to the country. I think it's important for people of color and for people of conscience to speak out unequivocally about all the different ways these structures of oppression certainly hurt those who are most oppressed by the structures, but also limit the possibility for our country as a whole.
Absolutely. Absolutely. You know, there are important conversations to have. You know, I know that when the election was going on, it was even so important for me to have conversations in my building with people in the elevator and have these important conversations. Because, like, listen, you ain't going to ignore my cute ass being in full drag in the elevator. I'm going to ask who you voting for, sis. We're going to have those conversations.
That's right.
Yes. I just want to say congratulations. You're running for the United States Senate. That is absolutely incredible. And what made you want to jump into that giant arena?
You know what? Because the Senate was not built for us. It wasn't built for us. And that's why I need to be there. The Senate is one of the most uniquely unrepresentative bodies in this country. You just think about the fact that there are more octogenarians than millennials in the Senate. You think about the fact that there are only 3 African-Americans in the whole body and only 11 so far who've ever served. I mean, over the course of this country, 11. Those numbers are damning. And again, as I've said, this is not about ornamental diversity. It matters to policy. When I think about the fact that I did get my first job at 12, washing dishes at a little vegan soul food restaurant to help my mom pay the utility bills. When I think about the fact that, as I said, I moved all the times that I moved, and think about the real cruelty of my mom working as a home health care aide, making sure other folks got their medicine on time, only to come home and ration her insulin. You know, and I buried both of my parents before I turned 27 because they didn't have access to good health care. And what I've experienced and what I know about government's inaction on issues that really matter and the brokenness that that leads to for so many communities, I know that in my bones. You know, my feet are bloody from walking over the glass of what government has or hasn't done. Many people in the Senate cannot say that. Most people in the Senate cannot say that. But when you think about all of the issues that come before that body, you know, and not just, you know, budgetary issues, we all think about the budget, but think about, you know, members of the cabinet that are approved and the questions that they aren't asked about what they're going to do to help certain communities who've been historically locked out, who have been historically held down and discriminated against. When you think about the fact that there are judges, and not just Supreme Court judges, which we all pay a lot of attention to, but also for district and appellate level courts, folks who will sit on the bench for 30 and 40 years in some cases, and you have people who are voting on these lifetime appointments who won't be here to deal with the impact of those decisions. You think about the Equality Act, or think about common sense gun safety, or, you know, think about things from investing in our Title I schools, or dealing with the existential crisis of climate change and creating a bunch of good green union jobs. These are things that across the board, there's a lot of synergy among the American people. Everything I just mentioned briefly, these things are deeply, deeply popular with everybody but the elite folks who are in the Senate. And so nobody expected, certainly not our founders, expected that a poor Black gay kid from North Philly would be a serious contender for the U.S. Senate. They did not expect it, but that is the very reason that I need to be in that building, in those rooms, in those hearings, talking about what I know, talking about the ground truth of what so many working families are dealing with every single day, people who are doing the jobs that enable our society to function, and the ways in which we dismiss and degrade their quality of life and their right to ultimately pursue their happiness. If we're going to have government that works for working people, we have to have working people in government. If we're going to have a government that works for all Americans, we have to have a government that reflects the fullness of all Americans' experiences. And right now, that body does not reflect it.
Absolutely. And listen, I can't wait for you to be that person.
And to be pissing Mitch McConnell off every day, I'm sure.
That baby, baby, I can't wait. I can't wait for it to shake things up. You know, listening to you talk, I get so empowered, and I get so, you know, it just makes me want to work even harder to create change within this country and to use my platform even more so. Truly, so many people get so excited because of Drag Race, and they see Britta, and they're like, she's a celebrity. Honestly, truly, I get so nervous talking to people like you because I look up to you. You are the superhero. You are the gay superhero that is like coming to make change, and it's so inspiring. And I just have to say thank you so much, and for giving us a voice, and especially as a person, a gay person of color, it is just, it's so inspiring. And I look forward to when you win that seat, and listen, I'm gonna come in full drag. Oh, we gonna have a party. I'm gonna do the numbers. We gonna play some Whitney Houston. Oh, we're gonna celebrate.
Whitney is, I don't know if that's in the Senate rules, but Whitney is always appropriate at any time. I think we can always take a break from Mama Whitney. But I will say this to you. You know, this is one of the things I learned talking about being a junior block captain. I always say you can draw a direct line from that to this race right now. Two of the things that I learned that I would always tell people to remember. First, nobody's coming to save us. But the good news is we don't need anybody to save us. A part of what folks do when they don't want to see systems and structures change is to first try to convince the people who can change the system that there's no hope of them changing it. You know, the best opponent is the opponent you don't have to have. If you can scare people or get people so apathetic that they don't utilize their power and that they just give it away, that's even easier. Because I tell you this, the opponents to our freedom, the opponents to our equality, to the justice that we need to see, those folks show up every time. They don't take an election off. They don't take a day off. They aren't tired. They aren't weary. If they don't get their way on one budget, they are coming back for the next budget. And we have to do that as well, because our power, it's not in just one voice speaking up. Our power is when a chorus of people are calling for change. demanding that things be different. You can't stop that. And I will tell people, don't wait on your neighbor, because a lot of time your neighbor is waiting on you. Somebody is waiting on you to get engaged. Yeah. There is somebody who's not going to show up to vote, who's not going to think about running for office until you, who's listening right now, steps up, because bravery is so contagious. And that is what's so powerful about what you're doing, Britta. You were a legend well before Drag Race, and you got on Drag Race, and a lot of people outside of the East Coast who maybe didn't know you already got to know you, got to see how talented you are. But the power of what you've done is that you've stepped up to be brave, to have brave conversations. And there are a lot of people who, by virtue of your bravery, decided to step up and be brave too. There is that ripple effect when we decide to live in our truth, and when we are crazy enough to believe that tomorrow can be better than today, there is a ripple effect of people who begin to believe that too. And when each of us does that, when we hold on to our power, when we don't give it away, when we don't hide it under a bush, but when we stand up and demand that this country don't just talk about freedom and justice and fairness, but that that be real, mm-hmm. when we all demand that that be real, there ain't a damn thing we can't do. Not a damn thing.
Absolutely. Hey, game into that, honey. Yes, yes, yes. You know, thank you so much. Thank you so much. This is everyone who's listening. You know, you got to be brave. You got to show up and show out and do the damn thing. It was truly such an honor to talk to you, and I'm so grateful. We've gotten so many amazing people, including your good friend Brian Sims, also on this podcast. Yeah. So it really means a lot that you came to talk to us and to share your wisdom, because it's so inspiring, and I'm wishing you the best. And baby, I can't wait until you win that seat, because listen, mama's gonna come down. We go party, baby.
It is. It's gonna be major. It's gonna be major history. I will be the first statewide African American, to represent the Democratic Party in Pennsylvania history, first openly gay. This is going to be major history, and I'm incredibly grateful that you would have me, and so proud, and can't wait to see you in New York slaying it and just doing what Britta does so well.
Absolutely, absolutely. And ladies and gentlemen, guys, gals, and non-binary pals, that is Representative Malcolm Kenyatta. I love it. I love it. Thank you so much for being a part of this.
Thank you.
A giant, warm, huge thank you to my very special guest, Representative Malcolm Kenyatta, World of Wonder, and everyone at Drag Out the Vote. I end this episode to let everyone know that, baby, we need to look out for each other. If you see something that's happening, baby, say something. Step in. Stop it. Black lives matter. Black trans lives matter. Stop AAPI hate. And lastly, make sure you are making your voices heard, because it truly does matter. Don't forget to rate, review, and subscribe to the You Britta Vote podcast on your favorite podcast platform, and listen to all of the podcasts that are part of the WOW Podcast Network. Till next time, remember, I'm a vote. So you Britta Vote, okay? Now serve it at the polls. Work. Serve. Come vote at the polls.
Girl, you finished with your ballot?
Come on, sis. Let's turn these in.
Wait, where's my sticker?
I got a free pin, though. You Britta Vote.